You are listening to Service Course by The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
You know, when we went to the show in Manchester, I think we'd done one show together, and this is something I'll talk about. And like Richard phoned me up and said, "Oh, I should just save this for the podcast."
I'm recording.
Richard phoned me up.
I'm recording it, so let's just roll with this.
Okay.
Carry on.
Yeah, Richard phoned me up. I'm not even sure if we'd done one show together and said, "Oh, we're doing the live show over in Manchester. Yeah, you should come. Bring your husband. It'll be really fun." And then by the end of the conversation, it had turned from "come and watch us at the live show" to "come on stage at the live show in front of hundreds of paying people and talk to them." It's just classic.
That was classic. Well, that was Rich's way. I mean, listen, Lizzie, I was just saying before we started recording that I don't really know how to start this show. This is our first show since Rich passed away. But I think I'm just going to start it with that because, well, hello, I'm Tom Wally and I'm with Lizzie Banks. Lizzie, it's Rich is how we know each other, isn't it?
It is. And I don't know where I would be without Richard. I would certainly be in a completely, my career would have taken a different path. I wouldn't have had these fantastic opportunities. I wouldn't have had this opportunity to come on Service Course, to meet you, Tom, to get to know you so well, to get to know this huge family within the Cycling Podcast, both of the people who work here and the phenomenal support of the wider family of listeners. And the last couple of weeks, we've really felt how strong that community is. I mean, I already knew how strong that community was before, but it's never been so strong as in the last few weeks when everybody has really come together to support the thousands and thousands of listeners who were touched by Richard over so many years.
No, it has been incredible. I mean, I've if you haven't listened to our celebration of Richard on the main episode, you know, do go and listen to it. I think a lot of people were maybe found it a bit too painful, but those who have listened to it, the reaction's been incredible, and I found it very therapeutic to listen to. But I think I've in that episode, I think I sort of said all I really wanted to say about how Rich has, you know, sort of impacted my life and brought people into it. But it was, you know, over the last few weeks, just listening to, well, I've actually found a lot of solace actually in, there's a Facebook group dedicated to the Cycling Podcast that we don't run, and you know, I've just dipped in and out of there to read people's tributes and hear people talking about Rich. And I would just like to thank everyone for all the kind things that they've been saying, and just being able to dip in and out of those conversations has been, you know, very helpful to me.
Likewise, Tom. I mean, you know, we're obviously so fortunate to have been able to personally know Richard and to have been encouraged by him and encouraged to do things that we'd probably never thought that we would do otherwise. Things that will and have changed the shape of our careers and lives, you know, no doubt for the better, but on a huge scale. And I too have been really touched by all of those messages, hearing about how Richard had changed people's lives in so many different ways.
And well, like I say, it was Rich that brought us together. I mean, I don't even know when it was now. It was the World Championships, wasn't it? Because we met at Betty's Tea Room in Harrogate. That was our first introduction.
Were you at Betty's? I don't think I met you there, Tom. No, I didn't. I didn't meet you there.
You met Richard there. You did, because, Lizzie, what happened was you met Richard there, and then I came up like maybe a day after you'd done a bit with Rich there, because I distinctly remember you speaking very loudly trying to get a tea sponsorship. Right, so I remember that. I was definitely in the room for that. What else do I remember? I can't remember. But yeah, it was Rich. It was you. I must have made such a great impact. It was you being Rich at base. There was only three of us there.
I've got photographic evidence of this, because I think it was Paul Watson, I think, friend of the podcast, who I was in Betty's with Richard without you, Tom. And he came and asked for a photo. And I remember this so vividly because Of course, Richard had made friends with the owner of the manager of Betty's, who was a big fan of the podcast and a big listener of the podcast. And Richard had managed to reserve this spot in the corner of Betty's for the cycling podcast for the whole week. And bear in mind, Yorkshire 2019 World Championships. If you don't know of Betty's, it's a very famous tea room in Harrogate. And it was absolutely packed. Queues, 100-metre queues out the door every single day. Of course, Richard managed to reserve this spot and get free food and drink for the whole week, which was brilliant. But actually, my first meeting with Richard was at the Women's Tour in 2019. And there's this brilliant bit of audio where you can hear Orla and Rose presenting me with a Pedaler de Charme t-shirt. And Richard in the background mumbling away, asking whether I'd like an extra small or a medium t-shirt. And that was my very first introduction to Richard. And later that afternoon, I was interviewed by him. And fondly, actually, I remember him saying in the podcast that I was one of the revelations of the Women's Tour, which I'll hold on to that piece of audio very closely. But he must have escaped my memory, you know, somehow after then, because it was such a short interaction. And I didn't know the journalists at that time. I was eager to speak to people, but I didn't know who anybody was. And about a month later, my press officer got in touch and said, "Oh, Richard Moore from the Cycling Podcast has got a proposition for you." Sent me his number, and I saved him in my phone as Richard Moore Cycling Podcast, because at this point, the magnanimity of who both Richard was and the Cycling Podcast were just hadn't registered with me. And Richard phoned up and he asked me to do an audio diary for the Giro d'Italia, which I think was released as a Friend of the Podcast episode in 2019. And it was obviously good luck because I managed to win a stage that year. And Richard was, as he always was, so enthusiastic about it, kept telling me how brilliant it was, which was lovely. And then another month or so later, completely out of the blue, I think I got a text from Richard saying, "Do you like tech, and are you interested in how bikes work?" Things like that. To which I replied, "Yes, but what on earth have you got up your sleeve now?" Then invited me to Betty's for this chat, which I'm sure you weren't there, Tom.
I'm gonna dig the photo out. I was absolutely there. I remember because the weather was grotty, and I bought.
The weather was grotty, but that doesn't narrow it down to a day, because it was grotty every day.
I've got one of those big bobble hats from the World Championships, and I bought it on that day. So that every time I wear that hat, I'm reminded that I was there.
Well, clearly you didn't make an impression the first time either. But at that point, that was where Richard proposed this idea to me of becoming a presenter on a podcast, which just seemed so wild. I mean, I'd done a couple of interviews after races, and then I'd done this Giro diary. But then presenting, being essentially a journalist, was not something that I was confident of doing and confident in knowing how to do. But the faith instilled in me through Richard and through you, through Richard, Tom, was enough to just make me believe that I could do something that I not only never done before, never thought I would do. But yeah, it was so characteristic of Richard have complete faith in somebody.
I think that's how we all know how the podcast started. You know, it was just a case of, well, listen, here's the idea, just do it, you know, just have a go. Because, you know, you can sometimes think of Rich as this kind of experienced, you know, godfather of podcasting, but he was still, you know, relatively new to it. And, you know, I was here to answer questions from Rich all the time, you know, about, well, how do you do this and how do you do that? But audio diary was basically like, I don't think you knew it, but it turned out to be an audition tape, basically.
An audition. You
know? That's what it was, you know. And I mean, it wasn't set up like that, but afterwards, I mean, I remember Rich saying, you know, what do you think about Lizzie? And I said, yeah, definitely. And that's why I came up to meet you in Harrogate, when you can't remember I was there.
But what about you, Tom? How did you go from being a producer to being a presenter on Service Course?
Well, I mean, again, sort of comes from... this is the story I tell myself. I don't really know. But obviously, I've done a bit of presenting anyway because I've been involved in radio for most of my life. So if you do that, you do end up on the microphone quite a bit. But I think, you know, I'd done a few bits and pieces for YouTube. But it was one of those ones where, you know, Rich is... I'd like to say it was Rich. Rich has got this idea and he's just looking for people to sort of fill that gap. And he obviously saw... The great thing about Rich was that he saw potential and he saw qualities in people, and not just one type of person. Because, you know, you and I are very different. You know, Lionel and Daniel are very different. Rose and Orla are very different people. But he could see the strengths of these different people and when assembling teams. And that's, you know, that's what he's done repeatedly, is assemble these teams. So, you know, he just said, I want to do a cycling tech show, and we sort of do tech in quote marks because, you know, we're much more than that, or much less than that.
Yeah, we very rarely talk about tech, just whatever takes a fancy. But it's amazing, isn't it? And every single episode, we would always have Richard within 24 hours telling us how wonderful it was, what he liked about it, you know, just how brilliant it was, just that constant enthusiasm. That constant belief that even when you maybe didn't feel like you'd done it justice, and you know, you always wanted to do justice to Richard, you always wanted to make Richard proud, and you know, there were always segments or interviews or, you know, little bits that you just didn't feel had gone very well, or sometimes you do an interview and you just, you know, you just can't really get what you want out of somebody, or somebody, sometimes you just can't nail down the interview you want because people are hard to get and you feel unsatisfied, and you just so desperately wanted to please Richard and to make him happy and to make him proud of what you'd done. But he was, his unwavering support for what we did always made us believe that, you know, next time it would be even better. It was brilliant this time and it would be even better next time. And you know, the way he championed women as well, and it's not because we were women. He didn't see gender. He saw talent, and he just saw talent no matter who you were. And then he would find a way. He would create a way to make an opportunity for you, like with Kate Wagner at the Tour de France, and like with me, and so many other people. And it was brilliant. You know, Richard became such a mentor to me. I would just pick up the phone about anything to him and give him a ring, and he'd always know. And he would always, if I needed to, I needed to get in contact with somebody, or, you know, I was having a bit of a meltdown in my life, which has happened quite a lot over the past couple of years, you know, he would always know what to do. And it was nice because I felt like I could give back as well, you know, as he was so enthused about the world of women's cycling and learning so much more about it and really pushing for increased coverage and doing such amazing things with the podcast as well. You know, I felt like I could give back and kind of provide him with more knowledge of the riders, access to the riders sometimes, insight to, you know, what rider might suit what feature. And it was just such a beautiful relationship. And I think that everybody who did and even didn't know Richard personally felt like they had that beautiful relationship, and that was Richard's magic.
Yeah, and I think one of the things is that I've enjoyed, but one of the things I've found comforting since Richard passed away is that a lot of us have been sharing our memories of what Rich meant to us, and we all had our own sort of relationship with Rich. He was a different thing to different people, but there are a lot of things that there are a lot of common threads to those relationships, and most common is that he saw something in me and he brought me in and he gave me opportunities. And I think, you know, yourself, me, Kate, Orla, Rose, we can all speak to that. And in hearing that Rich had those qualities for all of us independently just shows that he was really, really authentic. And that's one of the things that I take away from it. You know, my relationship with Rich, the qualities I saw in him were genuine and they were authentic and they were seen by other people. Well, like I say, you know, if you haven't already listened to it, please go and listen to the episode, Our Friend Richard Moore, where you hear many more stories and a lot more tributes. One person who wasn't able to contribute to that is another person that I have, and this is a common thread. There's lots and lots of people in my life, like you, Lizzie, who I've met because of Rich. And one of those people is Ian Boswell, you know, former World Tour rider, now excelling in the gravel, working for Wahoo, and a podcaster. So Rich basically made all of us podcasters.
Where did he get that from?
My relationship with Boz goes back to very early days of the cycling podcast, when Rich did this episode called The Young Americans, where he went out to Nice and he spent time with Larry Warbass, Joe Dombrowski, and Ian Boswell. And it was one of the sort of early sort of big friends of the podcast things I worked on with Rich, and it was fantastic. And you know, since then, I've felt closer to those riders. I've known them better, and I've got to know Ian over the years. So yeah, Ian wanted to pay his own tribute, so I asked him to come on Service Course. So here's Ian Boswell.
Hey everyone at the Cycling Podcast and Cycling Podcast listeners, Ian Boswell here. As many of you know, Richard Moore passed away a few days ago. I learned about the news and at first was completely shocked and just taken back by what an amazing man he was, what a connection I had with him personally, and the connection that we all, I think globally within the cycling community, had with Richard. I first had the chance to meet him probably in 2013 when I had first joined Team Sky and he came to a team camp, and we instantly hit it off. And throughout my entire time racing in the World Tour, we spoke regularly. I was oftentimes a guest on the Cycling Podcast, and he was really a pioneer in documenting cycling in an audio form that was both fun and insightful, and I think still to this day it is the most informative way of following the sport that I can find and that I know of, and that's the Cycling Podcast, and that's something that Richard Moore built and created and shared. And you know, I was fortunate enough to spend countless hours with Richard, whether it was on podcasts, you know, going out to dinner the few times that he came down to Nice to do the episode about the Young Americans, and then later on, I guess, the older Americans with myself, Larry Warbass, and Joe Dombrowski. And he was someone that I've stayed in touch with fairly closely since retiring from the sport, whether it be a guest on the podcast or just checking in. You know, he was a man who went above and beyond always. Last year during the women's Paris-Roubaix, a close neighbor of mine and a fan and friend of the podcast asked if there was somehow I could try to get one of the posters from the women's Paris-Roubaix, and who else did I think about reaching out to but Richard Moore? So I quickly sent him a text message. He was at the race, and a few weeks later, a poster from the women's Paris-Roubaix was sent to my house and is now hanging framed in my neighbor's house down the road. And it was just something that he did, and I'm sure he did things like this oftentimes for other people without even questioning it, without even asking for anything in return. Just a genuinely big heart and loving man. And I think going forward, it hasn't fully sunk in yet, the impact and the connection that we all have with Richard. I was out on a bike ride yesterday and there wasn't a new episode available of the Cycling Podcast. And I realized that I've listened to every single episode of the Cycling Podcast for probably the last 5 or 6 years. It's something that I really look forward to, especially during the Grand Tours when there's a daily episode. You know, it tends to kind of correlate during the spring and summertime here in New England, so I'm out riding more often, and every day when I head out on my bike, I put my headphones in, and I just hope that there is a new episode of the Cycling Podcast to accompany me on my ride. And I think that's what is going to be the hardest for so many of us to accept and to realize, is that Richard wasn't just a friend. He wasn't just a journalist. He was someone that accompanied us through everyday life. And the amount of times I, this may sound funny, fell asleep to Richard, Lionel, and Daniel's voice listening to the cycling podcast while taking an afternoon nap was countless. And I think his reach and what the podcast has become, and the voice and the characters and the ability for us to know them as journalists, but as people, has become such an integral part of so many of our lives. And I don't know what the plan is for the podcast going forward. I know it'll never be the same without Richard. And yeah, it's just hard to think about how Richard has come into so many people's lives, whether he knows them or not, that listen to him regularly, that know his perspectives, his feelings, and he shared so much with us. And it's going to be hard to continue on with the cycling podcast, listening to it as a fan and as a friend, without Richard there. But you know, he has brought so much to the sport, to the world of cycling, to his friends, to his family. And it's sad to think, and I just don't know when I will next be able to put in the cycling podcast and go out for a ride and not think of Richard. And maybe it's time to go back to episode one and start all over again and listen to the journey that he has put together for all of us cycling fans. I want to wish his family and his son well wishes. It's got to be completely mind-numbing for them what has happened, and I, as a recent father, can't really fathom what has happened and how tragic it was and how unexpected. And if there's anything I can do to help, please let me know. You know, I try to live my life without many regrets, but one of the regrets that I have since realized was not ever going on a grand tour with Richard. He's invited me a couple times now in the last couple years to go to the Vuelta and tag along with the cycling podcast and follow the Vuelta as a co-host. And I wasn't able to do it the last 2 years. And it's one of the few things in my life that I regret not doing while I had the chance. We always think there's another race, another year to do something like that. And it's a solid reminder that we shouldn't say no to opportunities that present themselves. So I love you, Richard, and thank you for everything you have done. You will be gravely missed, and I love you, buddy. Thanks so much for everything, and we will speak soon.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Please.
That is Seb Piquet interrupting to remind me to tell you that this episode of Service Course is sponsored by Harry's. Now, there's a few things in life that I won't tolerate. Discrimination of any kind, bad coffee, and bad pizza. Now, you can add to that list bad shaves, because I realise for much of my life I've been having poor quality shaves, and that's all changed since I started subscribing to Harry's. Now, Harry's are way more than a super sharp razor company. They are here to revamp your whole grooming routine, from close shaves and flake-free hair all the way to clear, healthy skin. Harry's helps guys feel good. Now, I'm here to tell you how you can get a free travel-size shower gel with your Harry's trial set. With that trial set, you get an expertly engineered weighted handle, 1 5-blade cartridge crafted by artisans in Harry's German factory, complete with precision trimmer, You get a handy foaming shave gel, a travel blade cover, and that free shower gel. And like I say, I've been using Harry's for the past few months. I love receiving my Harry's goodies. There's something about that weighted handle and the way it's presented in the box that makes you feel that this shave is special. And that's something that I haven't felt before. So if you want to take up the offer of the free shower gel with your Harry's trial set, all you'll need to do is cover the £3.95 for delivery. You just head to harrys.com/cycling to have your set delivered and start a shave plan. And your freebie will be added at the checkout. That's harrys.com/cycling. Thank you to Ian for those words. Lizzie, we're going to get back together at the end of this episode to talk a little bit about Roubaix, because obviously Roubaix is a feast of interesting and novel cycling tech. But before we get there, we're just going to spend about 45 minutes to an hour in the company of Dan Craven. Now, I don't know if you know Dan, better known as Dan from NAM. Originally from Namibia, and he's ridden for Namibia in the Olympic Games. I first encountered him when he was riding for Europcar, when he'd just come off the Vuelta, riding at World Tour level. He's now got his own bike brand, but not like many pros. It's not a big, you know, badged up carbon frame. This is proper nitty-gritty, getting down and making bikes by hand out of steel. So I spent a bit of time with Dan.
In Namibia.
In Namibia, yeah, exactly. So here he is. This is going to be a funny interview for me, because we're going to go around the houses, because, I mean, there is so much to talk to you about, and there's something very particular that I want to talk to you about, but I want to get to there. Yes. But obviously, one of the things I want to start with, obviously, you know, you're talking about, you know, it being difficult to get selection these days for you know, to race for Namibia, to race in the Commonwealth Games. Your kind of career is sort of sat alongside a big development in African cycling. So, I mean, has it just noticeably got harder in the races that you're doing, and, you know, in terms of, you know, being that number one rider, in terms of getting selected, the competition's just got better, right?
Completely. I mean, so many people now are suddenly aware of the Eritrean cyclists, for an example. I'm pretty sure if I went back on my Twitter several years, I recall myself once upon a time tweeting something and saying, like, world, watch out, they coming. And just being on the scene in Africa and having seen how it's developed over the years. I mean, my first All Africa Games were 2003 in Nigeria, and my first African champs, I think, was 2006. And I've been going very consistently to African Games, African champs, obviously Namibian events. And the level is just, it's a different world to what it had been back then. And it's absolutely amazing how it's all changed. It's amazing. And the Namibian scene, oh, I mean, night and day from when I started, completely.
Well, you should definitely take some credit for that. But I mean, going back to those sort of early days, and I don't want to sort of, you know, there's a kind of, you have to be sort of sensitive about how you do this, because you can kind of look at African cycling and look at all the differences, and, you know, maybe the poor quality of the equipment and stuff like that, and it can come across as patronizing. But I do want to go back then, and, you know, the other riders in those races, you know, what was their support like? What was their equipment like? I mean, it must have been, and compared to now.
I mean, as an example, I did a race in Rwanda in 2010, and I remember standing on the start line and looking next to me, and the guy next to me had a tire that had a slash in it that would have been 10 centimeters long. Wow. And he had stitched it with whatever it wasn't nylon, it was some cotton or something. And I'm on the start line and I'm looking at this tire that has been hand stitched to be able to reuse this tire. You know, clearly I didn't see the guy the moment the race started. He was out the back because you can imagine the guy who's got that kind of tire, you can imagine what the rest of his bike looks like, and you can imagine what his training and his home situation is like, and has he even had breakfast? I mean, some of the stuff we've seen. I mean, in Namibia, there was a young cyclist many years ago who we were trying to help out, and at one point, my mother was also helping him out, and we sort of realized that he wasn't washing his cycling bottles, and you know how gunky a cycling bottle could get. And we're like, wait a second, dude, you're not washing your cycling bottles. You need to look after your hygiene. And we didn't even realize that this man didn't have running water in his home or in his vicinity. Like, he would, how are you going to wash your cycling bottles if you don't have running water? And so you come with this sort of European mindset of, yeah, you wash your bottles, you put them in the dishwasher. And it's like, never mind a dishwasher, just running water in the home. Discovering like, oh, the person got dropped after the first attack in the race. But did that person actually have breakfast? Mm. You know, there's a whole different set of questions you need to ask in many occasions. And then it's like, well, then what happens if that person actually has breakfast every day? Like, how much, like, because they're already in the race. Without breakfast, what happens? And, you know, that's not the majority of the people in the race, but that is definitely a subset that exists there that doesn't exist in many other parts of the world. And it's not an easy fix, but the fact that it exists shows that there's this appetite for the sport, and that, I believe, is very exciting and very positive, because, you know, if the appetite is there, well, you know, then you can do something about it.
Well, let's get back to sort of Namibia. I mean, you know, it is Eritrea and to some extent Rwanda and these places that sort of get in the headlines, but people, we associate you most with Namibia. And I haven't got the kind of, I haven't got an idea of what Namibia is like as a country. So take me back to Namibia when you're sort of growing up. What sort of place is it, and what gets you into cycling?
Okay, so just a little bit on Namibia. Namibia is 6.5 times bigger than England. I think it's 3.5 times bigger than the UK in terms of surface area.
Is it that way on a map? Because obviously maps often make Africa look a hell of a lot smaller. That's where we sort of kind of lose perspective on a regular map, don't we? You know,
I mean, the UK is sort of a hard one to compare because it's oddly shaped. I believe Spain is a bit more square, so it might be easier.
Yeah.
I believe Namibia is 1.5 times bigger than Spain. And on the map, it might not look that, but if you go and look at the numbers. But now here's the surprising thing. Our population is the same as Greater Birmingham.
Wow. Okay. So it's sparsely populated then.
So it's the second most sparsely populated country in the world after Mongolia. We have 2.5 million people in the space 6 times the size of England. So yeah, we've got a lot of space, and that means we've got a lot of amazing wilderness and wildlife and animals. So if you want to come on safari, Namibia is like really high up there on the places you should go to, and is well known for that. But in terms of the things that our population, our people do, we're not so well known for that. And so with anything like cycling is, you know, it's not soccer, it's not rugby, it's a smaller sport. It's, you know, in the population numbers like that, and if you take the income of your average Namibian into consideration and what bicycles cost these days, it sort of becomes a smaller and smaller and smaller little subsection. But again, cycling is the new golf, and it's just absolutely in skyrocketing.
I mean, that's interesting. Obviously, there's a practical side to that, you know, to connecting people, but also there's the sort of sports side. But how did cycling reach you then as a kid growing up there? Because it would seem like a world away from what you're living, right?
I mean, keeping in mind that until recently, I was the only elite Namibian athlete who doesn't come from the capital.
Right.
Now, the guy who went to Tokyo for mountain biking, the male, he comes from even more the middle of nowhere than I come from. But he got into it because there was a cycling event local to him. And by local to him, I mean 150 kilometers away. And so, yes, everyone is almost Windhoek, which is the capital based. I'm, for many, many years, was the only guy who wasn't from Windhoek. And basically, when I was 5 years old, I watched a triathlon. That memory stuck in the back of my brain. And when I was about 16, 15, I was at a soccer tournament and I saw an advert for a triathlon and just all of these emotions came flooding back. And I was like, I need to do that. And slowly, you know, got duathlon, triathlon, discovered that swimming and running meant nothing to me and cycling was just freedom and beauty and this thing that could take me places and amazing.
But obviously, but then taking the leap from, you know, just having a bike in the backwoods of Namibia to actually, you know, racing on the road, was that something that sort of developed when you were at university then or studying?
Oh, yeah, I discovered triathlon when I was still in high school. And to me, the closest high school was in the next town. The next town is 140 kilometers away. So I was in boarding school, but Namibian boarding school, which is not like British posh boarding school. It's like necessity boarding school where some farmers' kids have been, you know, from the age of 6 years old, they've been in boarding school 200, 300 kilometers away because it's the only way they can go to school. And it was a German boarding school, so I had to learn German very quickly. And the reason for that is because Namibia used to be a German colony. There's still a very strong German culture in Namibia. And I was obviously playing soccer because I'm with all of the Germans and discovered the triathlon, got into it, was like, this is what I'm doing. The town I was in obviously didn't have a swimming pool. So on weekends, I would go home and we'd have this water reservoir / swimming pool / fish in it and green and muck at the bottom. That was 16 meters long and I would train in that. And I would think that I was taking this super seriously. And there was one other guy in town who rode a bike and he like had a belly and he was like an insurance guy. And like I learned everything I could from him, which wasn't much, but at the time was everything. And then to run, I would find a few buddies I could run with. So that was like, I thought I was taking it so seriously. But in hindsight, it was like, okay, maybe not. But so many of my peers had never even heard of the sport called triathlon. They had no idea what I was doing, couldn't really understand it. So it was only when I left school and I went to university in South Africa and I went to Stellenbosch, which is basically where the Cape Epic always goes through. It's like a massive hub of mountain biking. But back then it was a massive hub of triathlon. I mean, Tim Don, British triathlete, used to spend lots of time there. And I was like, yay, I'm going to university in this triathlon mecca. And I joined the cycling club and went on interesting roads for the first time in my life on a road bike. And I was like, wait a second. This is what cycling can be like. And I never did another, never mind triathlon, swimming session, running session. I was just head over heels in love with it. And, you know, I mean, Stellenbosch cycling is good. Mountain biking is amazing. Road cycling it's decent, but compared to what you get in Europe, I mean, it's... So when I came overseas, I was just absolutely blown away 10 times over by what one can do with road cycling.
It's interesting. You still talk about, you know, like road cycling, what it exposes you to, you know, the beauty, the things that you see. Obviously, when you start racing, it's literally from town to town, race to race unit. But did you still, you sound like you still hung on to that kind of, I want to experience the place I'm in, otherwise there's no point to this sport.
Yes. I mean, I am, if you look on pro cycling stats, there's that statistic.
There's a very interesting statistic. Yeah, I want to talk about that. Yeah.
most countries raced in, so that's official UCI races. I am second on the list of most countries raced in. I think I'm like 44 countries that I've done official UCI races in. And I mean, that wasn't on purpose. That was just how my career developed. Like I was, you know, had I been good enough to be in a World Tour team, I would have just been racing in Belgium and France and Italy and Spain. That's it. But I was just always hungry for more and ended up, call it injury issues, call it wanting to explore various different reasons. I sort of bounced around a bit on a few interesting teams that would go to interesting places and do interesting races. And that really, I just love it. I mean, so interesting going to somewhere. I mean, you know, with everything that's happening in Ukraine right now, in 2014, there had just been, you know, a few things that happened in Ukraine in 2014. And we went to Ukraine in the middle of the year in 2014 to do a race. And one of my teammates at the time, his parents didn't let him go because it was like, oh, there's war going on there. And we got there and it was like, wait, no, we're in Kiev. We're in the town square where like the massive protests happened. And we were there and it was like, yeah, it's not so bad. I'm not saying what's happening now is not so bad. I'm just saying at the time we were there in 2014. And it's just so eye-opening, sort of the opportunities that traveling would give us to see things aren't always what you expect them to be. And sometimes they're a lot worse than you expect them to be. Like I'm guessing now, in my experience, everything I'm hearing, I expect it to actually be worse than what we're hearing. Whereas back then, you know, it ended up everything was 10 times better than what we expected for that time period. And just all of this traveling just sort of makes you realize how little you know and how little people around you know and how interesting things are if you go to places. I mean, it's just thinking of this another time. I was in Cameroon, also happens to be 2014. And one of my best meals I ever had was in Cameroon in a super busy traffic circle in the middle of a city. There was this little hut set up on the side of this traffic circle, and this guy was selling food and he was selling omelets and salads. And I saw someone have something. I was like, I want that. And once again, my teammates who were with me, they were like, no, it's okay. We're going to eat at the hotel. We're not going to order from this place. And the guy started, you know, cracking eggs and whipping up this omelet, and he made a tomato avocado mayonnaise salad that was just mind-blowing and the most delicious and freshly made. I mean, in places like Cameroon and Rwanda, avocados grow year-round. If an avocado falls off a tree, people will like walk over it and step on it because it's like there's so much of it, it's so abundant, it's not special like it is here. And my goodness, I'm my mouth is literally watering just thinking of that meal again. And all of my teammates see my food coming out and they're like, whoa, wait a second. And everyone pounded in and had the same thing. And it was just, who, like, you know, I start describing the scene, this super traffic busy, you know, Africa somewhere city, and then you don't expect the meal you have there to just be amazing. And it's like the preconceived ideas that one tends to have, you know, everyone wants good food. No one wants to eat nonsense. Like we have more in common than there are differences if you just want to open yourself up to it.
Who has raced in more countries than you? Who is it? Who's above you? Can't think who it is.
I mean, I know him, obviously. His name escapes me right now. But funnily enough, actually, this is funny. I was talking to him not long ago because his grandmother's sister is actually buried in Namibia. Okay. He's a Romanian German, but his grandmother's sister is buried in Namibia. So we were discussing her grave, and I actually sent a friend there to go and take a photo of it.
Wow.
And so we spent many years racing together. And
Patrick Tybor, isn't it?
Patrick Tybor.
That's who I've got on the list. There's 46 nations. And then there's Lars Prier, who's below you.
Yeah, Lars Prier. Who's Patrick Tybor? He's new to the list.
Shall we find out about Patrick together?
I'm number three then.
So you're number two. You're ahead of Lars on this list that I've got. So you're still number two. So he is he's Slovakian. Been on the same continental team for looks like his entire career since 2006. And he's still active. So
which team is that? Is that Praha?
It's a Dukla Banska Bystrica, they call it at the moment. Yeah.
It used to be called Dukla Praha.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Then I. Oh, I did not realize he jumped ahead of us.
Yeah, he's on 46. We've got you down as 45 on this list. Lars at 44 and Patrick at 46. So
I believe I raced Patrick in this Cameroon race that I'm just talking about.
Ah, really? Okay.
If not, then he definitely raced Cameroon at a different time. But
I'd be interested to get you guys in a room just to kind of compare notes. But I mean, talking of all these exotic locations, I actually first encountered you at Alexandra Palace. And you mentioned earlier on that, you know, you said something along the lines of you weren't good enough for World Tour, but at the time you were a World Tour pro because you were riding for Europcar had been promoted then, hadn't they? So you were a World Tour pro and you came to race the Rafa Supercross at Ali Pali. And I remember, you know, shooting you with foam, you know, foam guns and that sort of stuff. And I was pretty surprised, actually. I thought, here's, you know, again, another example of a World Tour Pro sort of breaking the mold, really, you know. Maybe you were ahead of the game with this sort of alternative race calendar back then.
Oh, man, I am so jealous of Lachlan and call it the opportunity that he's, shall I say, created for himself.
He has created it. And you go back to those first thereabouts films. He's created this himself, yes. No doubt.
Oh, man, but such a dream. Like that would have, oh, man, I wish I could have been a bit more like that. But so basically I had just raced the Vuelta and it was off season. Actually, we'd just gone to China after the Vuelta, got back. It was off season. My then girlfriend, now wife, lived in London, so I spent a lot of time there. And you're wrong, I did not come to race the Rafa Supercross. I came to race
That's right, you raced the fun race where you were drinking tequila.
I came to race the fun race, and then I got there and they told me the one team is missing a rider for the Supercross. We're going to use you. And I was
that's right.
I have no idea how to race cyclocross. So they gave me someone, they found Bruce Dalton and he showed me how to hop over the barriers for 10 minutes. That's the training I had. And then off we went with the Supercross and it was so much fun. I just had an absolute blast, but I was there for the foam cannon for that race.
You already had a few tequilas in you before that race, I remember.
It was a tequila shortcut in the race. So I did the serious race. I had fun. It was amazing. I wish I could do more. But the reason I was there was for the fun race. And the fun race, no one cared who finished first. No one cared about anything except the fact that the biggest foam cannon in Europe was at the start line and that there was a tequila shortcut. Which means you can do a shortcut. You don't have to do the full lap, but you have to take a shot of tequila. And let's just say the tequila shortcut ran out of tequila, and I might have been part of the reason for that, because I did lots of laps and I took tequila every single time. And at some point, someone whipped out a hip flask that had whiskey in it. So I started mixing my drinks mid-race, and this foam can, I mean, the biggest foam cannon in Europe, I think it had just come from Mallorca because the summer had just ended, and for winter, yes, they were going to use it in the UK, something like that. But it just arrived from Mallorca. I remember that. And there was foam about, I mean, at least 4 feet of foam, you know, call it a meter 30, a meter 40 deep of foam. And one of the laps, the guy who was in front of me slipped, because obviously foam is slippery and grass with foam is very slippery, slipped and fell in the foam and completely disappeared from sight. And the foam closed up over him. And had I not seen him crash in front of me, I would not have believed that there was someone on the ground. And basically, I was just laughing for however long the race. I mean, it was 30 minutes or something like that. And I was just constantly laughing. I surprised I could even pedal my bike.
I've got a photo of you somewhere alongside my mate who's dressed like a panda in that race. Yeah. So it was a good old day out. But I mean, it's funny. I mean, going back to sort of, I mean, I do associate you with London. Obviously, I was living there at the time. Mm-hmm. But so obviously, I mean, I want to talk to you about your latest venture and you're going into frame building. But what? It's wrong to say you're going into frame building, because I didn't realize that sort of your interest in frame building starts around 2008 and back at the time when you were racing with Rafa. So do you want to talk a bit, well, Rafa Condor, do you want to talk a little bit about how you sort of got into that back in the day?
Well, as you say, it was actually 2009, 2010, racing for Rafa Condor. And Condor, you know, they make race carbon beautiful bikes, but they also have a large array of steel bikes and a very long history and amazing people who've raced their bikes over the years. And at some point in 2010, I can't quite remember why, but I asked them, don't you guys have a steel bike that is raceable? Because they look pretty nice to me. And they said, no, we don't really. But, you know, we might be thinking about it. And a few months later, I got a message from the crew at Condor and they said, oh, we just got one in, a prototype. Would you like to try it? And I was like, of course, would I like to try it? Of course, I'd like to try it. So they sent it up to me when I was living in Manchester at the time, and this bike arrives. It was just stunning. And one of my biggest memories of this bike, which was nicknamed the Steely Dan for obvious reasons, was that I raced on it many times, and quite often in races, people would come up to me and be like, Dan, where's your steel bike? And I'd be like, I'm on it. And they'd be like, no, that's a carbon bike. And I was like, no, this is the steel bike. And I think so many people have this misconception of what a steel bike means. It's like everyone knows what Eddie Merckx's steel bikes look like. And to many people, I think that's still what a steel bike is. Whereas a modern steel bike, like the technology, exactly, in the background.
On behind me.
Like the technology in steel, it's not like it stood still since the 1960s. It's kept growing, and steel tubing has been able to change and develop and get stronger and lighter and all of these amazing things. I mean, if you think about the first carbon fiber bikes we had in the early 2000s, late 1990s to now, I mean, they were miles apart. And that's something very similar has happened with steel. So me in 2010 riding this steel bike that some people thought was a carbon bike, I was kind of so amused that people didn't realize that back then. And I raced didn't race a full Tour of Britain on it, but I raced several stages in the Tour of Britain on my steel bike, you know, against World Tour teams. And I actually raced the Tropicala Misabongo, which was Africa's biggest stage race at the time, the only race in Africa where Tour de France World Tour teams could race. And that's actually where I made the connection to Europe Car and where they met me and became interested in me. And I won the King of the Mountains jersey in 2010, 11, on a steel Condor. And the King of the Mountains jersey, you know, where everyone is like, oh, steel weighs a ton. And so from there it developed, and Rafa did this whole continental series, the Gentleman's Rides. And with that, they had five builders build steel bikes for them that were then all logoed up. And with the builders' names, obviously, like Independent Fabrication, Indy Fab. And one of the builders was Ira Ryan. And for some reason, his specific bike just sort of caught my attention the most. And I was like, oh, this thing is beautiful. And reading all of the blurbs, and I discovered that Ira had been building bikes for only, is either 3 or 5 years at the time. And I was like, wait a second, you are good enough that you're building bikes for a Rafa show bike, which in my mind was like very high praise, but you've only been doing this for 5 years. You're not like Colnago, who's been building bikes for 60 years, or Condor, who's been building bikes for 60 years. You've been building bikes for 5 years, and you're not an engineer. You're not, but this bicycle is beautiful. I mean, it took my breath away. And so like, who do you think you are? Like, you're just some dude. And I mean, clearly not, you're just some dude. I've met him. He's amazing. He builds amazing bikes, and the bikes are now breadwinners, and like breadwinners are beautiful and amazing bikes. But I was kind of like, if you can do that, then can I do that? And that sort of got this idea rolling in my head. And I was like, wait a second, if I can do that, then who else can do that? Like, can we do this in Namibia? So it was way back in 2010 that this sort of crazy little seed got planted in the back of my brain. And in 2012, I then went to the Bicycle Academy in Frome in the UK, not far from Bath. And I took a 5-day frame building course. And, you know, I walked in there. I'd never used a brazing torch, you know, oxyacetylene, big flame, brazing rods. I didn't even know what oxyacetylene meant. And, you know, I mean, just oxygen and acetylene, the two gases that burn, that, you know, make a flame up to 900 degrees to melt the brass, and all of these things that, like, I knew nothing about. And 5 days later, I had learned this, and I'd built a frame. I was like, wait, I can build a frame in 5 days? Like, once again, if I can do this, then other people can definitely also do this. And then my cycling career continued, and obviously this all got put on the back burner. But that's sort of where this whole idea first started off, and it's taken a very long time to go from there, building my first two bikes actually in 2012 and building another bike in 2016, always in different workshops, always with different masters.
Where are those bikes, by the way? Do they still exist?
So the first one I built was basically, we built Buffalo bikes that were then built up, and we're going to go to somewhere in Africa to a development program. And I obviously got involved with that, and they went to Namibia.
Of course.
So those bikes are in Namibia. I still see them every now and then, which is obviously amazing.
Wow, that's so lovely. That must be lovely to see that bike still being used. That's
crazy. I don't know which ones I see, because I don't know if I actually see mine, because there was about 100 of them.
Right.
Well, there's probably more actually that were all sent out. And a lot of them have been converted into e-bikes, because there's this amazing project in Namibia that does all of that. And my second bike was a 29er mountain bike that I built, that I immediately then took off to Namibia and raced our version of, I'm going to call it Unbound, the big gravel event in the US, which is in Namibia, it is the Desert Dash. It is now 394 kilometers long, 24-hour cutoff time, goes from the capital to the coast. But at the time, it was only 340 kilometers. And, you know, I built my own bike. And 2 weeks later, I went and won the Desert Dash on this bike that I'd built. And it was like, well, these bikes can move. You know, they're not bad. That bike still belongs to a friend of mine. Well, still belongs to me, but a friend of mine is riding it. So I see it every time I'm back in the capital. And then the third bike I built, which was the first gravel bike I built, was passed on to a friend. And he's since then passed it on to another friend. And I'm in Girona at the moment, and it is in Girona. So I still see that quite often, which I still laugh every time. And the second bike was built with Robin Mather, who is an amazing frame builder, amazing human being, prize winning, et cetera, et cetera. And then the third one was built with Matthew Sauter of Saffron Frameworks in London, another really good friend.
Beautiful bikes. Yeah, really beautiful.
So Robin, unfortunately, doesn't really build anymore, but Matthew does in his bikes. I mean, I own a Saffron. My wife owns a Saffron. They are just like, you want a Saffron, basically.
The paint jobs on the Saffrons are stunning, aren't they?
I mean, and also being in his workshop, seeing how he works, how particular he is.
Yeah.
You want a Saffron. And so, Robin actually came out to Namibia on two occasions for a month each to help with teaching and developing and more learning in Namibia. So like the great thing about the seed being planted way back in 2010 is that I basically had all of this time to meet people and to slowly but surely, you know, while I'm still in the cycling racing industry, you know, it's quite easy to sort of branch into the cycling frame building community and sort of meet people and make connections and find out things. And so when in 2017, the injuries finally made racing not viable anymore, shall I say, the contracts not coming in anymore, then it was like, okay, well, maybe it's time now to really do something with this idea of mine. And it's just grown and grown and grown. And we are now in Girona in Spain, where we've lived, basically to pack up to move back to Namibia full time, because we want to do things properly and have a go at this.
So what is it? Let's tell us about the brand and the bikes that you're going to be making. I mean, is your focus on, you know, creating race bikes for the next generation, or is it literally, you know, creating bikes that are practical and that can be built simply, and you know, they're sturdy and they're usable, and you know, in terms of and making a difference in that sort of sense, the way that sort of a charity like Quebecca, for instance, has made a difference.
So what you've just said is the first reaction we very often get, and I completely understand where that comes from, and I often think that way myself, but that's actually the exact thing we're trying to avoid, because so many people, they think of, I say so many people, almost everyone, like we globally have been sort of a lull into this world where you think of Africa, you think of poverty, you think of no skills, you think of people needing help, you think of charity.
You think of white savior, don't you? That sort of thing, you know.
Completely. And I'm Namibian. I don't need charity. I mean, yes, I'm a white Namibian who comes from a fortunate family and everything, but Namibia and Africa as a whole, we don't need more charities. What we need is business. Like, do you want to send a kid to school for free and help the kid go to school? Or do you want to give the kid's parents a job and the parents are proud and have an income and the parents can send their own kids to school? I mean, what would you rather have? To me, it's absolutely a no-brainer. Like, you want to improve the living conditions of the entire community. And if there's an opportunity to do that, then why would you ever do charities? And so, like I said, Africa does not need more charity. Africa needs more business. And we are building beautiful, top-class, desirable steel bicycles that I want to ride, and I want people in London and Portland and Amsterdam and Tokyo to want to ride, like, high value, beautiful bicycles that are just anyone would want. I mean, a Speedwagon, a Mosaic, a Saffron, you know, they come from London and Portland and Boulder, and no one asks a question about, is this a project or is this a charity? You know, it's a business. And now I'm starting a business in Namibia, and it's a business. And I want everyone who's involved in the business to make money, because that's what businesses do. And I want the money to make lives better, because that's what businesses do. And so we are building beautiful, desirable bikes. The difference is we're doing it in a place that people don't expect it to happen. But that doesn't change anything about our quality and our standards and how much effort has gone into getting the best and the most beautiful bicycles out of it. And we there's so much that goes with that. We've already sent one bicycle to ISO testing. We've updated a few things on how we do things, and we want to use more silver brazing than brass brazing. And the whole thought about that is you just lower the temperatures and go into more specifics and details about that. But we are now about to send our second frame to ISO testing, because, you know, you need to know that what you're doing is actually good. I mean, it's very easy to braze two tubes together, and you take a hammer out and you hit those things and they do not come apart. Very easy to know that the work is going to hold. But, like, what does that mean exactly? Like, and that's why we're sending it to ISO testing, so that we can show people, like, on a certificate, like, this is what it means. This is, you put it in this stand and it gets shaken this way 100,000 times, and then this happens, and, like, it lasts, you know. And we need to also, like, we actually have just sent a bicycle to London yesterday. We are sending, this bike is going, I believe it is called the Cycle Show.
In
Alexander Palace, where we met.
That's the one.
Where the panda might still be running around. The Cycle Show is next weekend, which I believe is the 22nd of April. And there is a competition there where I believe 12 bikes will be on show. And if I understood it correctly, the public at the show can vote for their favorite bike. And, you know, whoever wins the vote wins the prize. And SRAM and Zip got an invite, and they selected us as, well, I don't believe I've even said the name of our bicycles.
You haven't? Now I keep trying to tease it out of you.
We so much to talk about. Onguza, which I'll circle around to what that means, but Onguza Bicycles, SRAM and Zip have been this amazing partner. Funnily enough, my main contact at SRAM and Zip, I met at that cyclocross race back in 2014. So that shows you once again, like, how long that relationship has been growing and building. And the first time they they physically helped me. SRAM was in 2016 already, and then 2017 they got involved, and like they've basically been, since I've been doing things, they've been involved. So like them together with Columbus in terms of products have been my most important allies. And it's just, you know, products that like I've chosen them because they are the brands I want to work with, but they have fortunately also chosen me and, shall I say, Onguza as a brand they want to work with. So SRAM and Zip received an invite to send a bicycle to this show, and they chose Onguza, which, I mean, it kind of just melts my heart that they thought that we were worthy of this. But on the other hand, yes, we are worthy of this. Like, we have put in so much work, and our bicycles are good, and our story is good, and we've made a beautiful gravel bike, which is definitely a showstopper.
Yeah.
And it's going to be on show at Ali Pali at the Jaw Droppers competition, and I hope any of your listeners can go and vote for us, and but go and see the bike and appreciate it for what it is, because it's so much work and effort has gone into that to get to where we are today, and there's so much work that lies ahead. And anyone who can't make that show, hopefully, you know, there's so many more shows we want to go to.
There's so many, yeah. Bespoke, yeah, yeah.
In October, really, yeah. We definitely are going to be there just to be able to show people hands-on what we are doing, because most of our sales is going to be online. Just the fact that we're sitting in Namibia and our target clients are international. I mean, the reason for that is, it's not that I'm not going to sell to Namibians or South Africans, but I want to show the world also what amazing products we can make. And the only way to do that is, well, to sell them internationally. To like, so that is the main drive, is to send them away, not keep them locally. Bring in the euros, bring in the dollars, bring in the yen into the Namibian economy, and show the world that Namibia can make something really beautiful, and Africa can make something beautiful. And in my own tiny little corner in the world, sort of try to nudge that balance of what people think of when they think of Africa, and they immediately start thinking charities and giving. And it's like, no. We have amazing people with amazing culture and character and humor and skills, and we can do amazing things.
Well, I wanted to ask you, obviously, you're making these bikes in Namibia, and you know, no matter where a bike comes from, it's normally got a little bit of influence of that place that it comes from. And now, with your bikes, is that influence, do we see it simply in the name Onguza, which I'd love you to explain what it means, but is there any other sort of detailing in the bike that sort of says, hey, we're from here, whether it's a paint job or a component or just any sort of bit of detailing in there?
Yes, and yes. So let's start off with the gaping hole so far, Onguza.
Yeah.
Which, if one wants to do the full thing, you would say Okuti Onguza. So Onguza is spelled Onguza. And if it is a Herero and Ovahimba word, which is a local languages, two linked but separate local languages. And Okuti Onguza means the vast expanse or the desert. So generally you think of it, no one lives in the desert or tries not to live in the desert, shall I say. But so when you're talking about the desert, you tend not to be in it. So it's the desert yonder. It's the desert over there. It's sort of the displacement. So we found that term and we absolutely loved it. It's also a slightly old word in those languages. So it's not super common. And it just felt right for a Namibian brand, for us, for the area we're in Namibia. We're on the edge of the desert. People speak those languages where we come from. And I absolutely love it. And also it's spelt the way you pronounce it, even though in Herero, that people, they, the Z at the end, they say Onguza, but we are not doing that. We're simply saying Onguza as one.
Just a little bit Spanish, that wasn't it?
It does. It does have a little bit of a Spanish sound to it. So that's the name. Our bikes are, in a certain way, very representative of where we come from. That's why our first bikes that we're selling are gravel bikes, because in Namibia, a lot of people in the Namibian cycling scene ride on gravel on mountain bikes, you know, but they're full suspension because of the corrugations in the roads. Yeah. But if you want to cycle from Cairo to Cape Town through Africa, you would rather have a gravel bike than a full suspension mountain bike. Just the amount of stuff that can go wrong.
Yeah.
And you would much rather have a steel gravel bike than a carbon one. Just the chances of anything going wrong are just reduced, reduced, reduced. And so there's a certain simplicity to it. Now, simplicity also comes with sounds like cheaper, and that is not what I'm implying.
Well, when I say simplicity, I think of elegance and, yes, of, you know, beauty. You know, exactly. I mean, I ride a, you know, I ride a fixed gear, yeah, but a single, but you know, it's not the, it's the simplicity. But like I say, the simplicity is the beauty, it's the elegance in,
exactly,
it,
exactly, you know,
the purity.
Yes, exactly. So that is what we're going for, something that is absolutely rough and robust. And if you want to cycle across Africa, it's sort of an ideal build for that, but it's you can ride wherever and it's always going to look elegant and beautiful, and your children could inherit it from you one day, or you know, you could repaint it and it'll be like a new bike next year. And obviously you can do that with carbon bikes and other things, but the carbon sort of, you don't really, yeah, do it the way you do with a steel bike.
No, not at all.
And so we are starting off with gravel bikes. That's our main stay, shall I say. And that is also what the show bike is that's going to the cycle show. But we've already built a 29er mountain bike, hardtail. I've built several road bikes. In fact, I was actually going to race an Onguza road bike at the Tokyo Olympics last year until I got COVID 24 hours before flying out to Tokyo. Man. And that bike is completely different once again, because it's, you can't go to the Olympics with just a farm gate. You have to go on a competitive bike. So my plan was, what is the best bicycle we can build in our workshop? And it has aerodynamic 3D printed stainless steel headset, head tube lugs, bottom bracket dropouts. It's got a carbon fiber integrated seat post and steel tubing.
I want one. I want one now.
And it's got a integrated handlebar and fork that are 3D printed titanium. This bike is, it's the bee's knees. And
that sounds like my dream build, actually, because I've been kind of, I have been talking to a few frame builders about what I want, and I've not pressed go on this project yet, but you know, it was always that sort of, you know, beautiful steel frame, didn't you, but then with a really modern front end, that really sort of futuristic cockpit. Yes. Which sounds like what you're describing, really.
Yes, exactly. I hope everyone wants one, but not everyone will want to pay for one. Those are going to,
yeah,
the amount of work and tech that went into those bikes. And I mean, I had two aeronautics engineers helping me out. Josh Portner from Silka, the amazing brand in America. He was involved on the project. Like Columbus was involved on the project. Tom Sturdy of Sturdy Cycles, he was heavily involved in the project. In fact, the handlebar and the fork are basically Sturdy off the shelf. The rest of the parts were made specifically for me, but you can still see the Sturdy hand in them. I say for me, for Onguza. But this bike really, really blows me away. And it will also blow the bank away. You know, we're talking significantly over £10,000, yeah, for a full-built bicycle. But it's a special world class. It was supposed to race at the Olympics. Like, it's worthy of that. And that's the kind of bicycle we can build, and we can show the world that we can build amazing things that are different, because it was a bicycle that it was the best possible bicycle we could build in our workshop. You know, it's built in our workshop in Namibia. It's not put together there. It's built there. You know, there's a very significant difference. Like the workmanship that went into that bike. So there's that bike. But there's also, shall I say, normal. We've built some normal steel road bikes, and we can the beauty with steel, you can build whatever you want to in certain ways. And we haven't built a full suspension mountain bike yet, but that's, I mean, it's a matter of time, because
you sort of relish the challenge of whatever comes in. In terms of the building, actually, you know, you've spoken about are your hands on these frames when they're being built, or are there some other sort of great frame builders that we should be paying tribute to?
A mix. And now that I'm moving back to Namibia, my hands are going to be on the bikes more than they were. But we have two local gentlemen, Zacharias Nkolo and Petros Mufenge, who are part owners in Onguza. These gentlemen just have always had amazing skills with their hands, and you just have to, we've given them a product that is worthy of the skills that they already had, and they are absolutely relishing it and showing that the initial idea I had has feet. So at the moment, there are two guys in the workshop. They're in the workshop in Namibia right now. I will be joining them very soon. They will continue to do most of the work, but I will be, you know, because answering all the emails and ordering things and talking to customers, that takes up a lot of time. But I'm also hands-on in the workshop, and we are hoping to, depending on how orders go and how everything goes, the plan is to very slowly but surely, you know, grow that. But training takes its time. It all needs to be top class work. You can't just add people very quickly.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you, as ever, to Science in Sport for their continued support of everything that we do here at the Cycling Podcast. We've talked a lot over the last few weeks about Richard Moore and how much we'll miss him and the things that will remind us all of Rich. And I think for all of us, if we go to a bike race, we'll be reminded of Rich. If we watch a bike race on the TV, we'll be reminded of Rich. If we just listen to a podcast, we'll be reminded of Rich, particularly this podcast. But I think I'll also be reminded of Rich every time I mention the Science in Sport offer code. That's because Rich was pretty much the only person in the Cycling Podcast family who didn't get that offer code wrong. Daniel and I and Lionel have been terrible at it in the past, Daniel and I particularly. But if you want to get 25% off your next Science in Sport order, and why wouldn't you, obviously, just go to scienceinsport.com and enter the offer code SISCP25. That's SISCP25.
Well, Tom, I think that Dan Craven was actually the first professional rider that I sort of knew by name and followed, because he was made famous with GCN fame.
Of course, yeah.
And the brilliant "that was grotty" saying. I hope I did you justice there, Dan.
That was very accurate. That was really good, Lizzie. Another string to your bow. Well done.
And he was just such a character that I was really drawn into. Drawn into the characters of professional cycling, and he was one of the characters, as you said, as he was riding for Europe Car back then, who drew me in.
It's funny, isn't it, with we were talking a little bit. I've been sort of reflecting on
with Richard passing, I don't want to bring it back to that again, but you know, with Richard passing away, we've sort of talked about the way he championed women's cycling, and I kind of see women's cycling as the way it's perceived now is kind of caught up with Richard's view. And it's Dan's similar, you know, the stuff he was doing about African cycling, I feel like the sport has sort of finally caught up a little, well, not quite caught up, but you know, it's almost there at the, you know, it's almost realized exactly what he was trying to tell us all along, you know what I mean, that there's talent out here and you know, we need to recognise it and expand the sport, you know.
Well, I guess that's the motto. If you believe in something, then keep pushing it and eventually it'll get there. But no, it's amazing to hear about how things are changing in African cycling. And of course, we've got the World Championships in Rwanda in 2024, which many have...
Sorry to interrupt there, but this is a corrections corner. The World Championships in Rwanda are, in fact, in 2025. So sorry to disappoint you there, but an extra year to wait for the first African UCI World Championships. And I'm just putting it out there, by the way, but I would love to go.
Many have slated, really, for various reasons. I mean, there's a whole kind of another series of podcasts on that alone. But hearing Dan speak about African cycling and about how it's changed, you know, in the last, well, 10 years, really made me think, well, it made me change my opinion about the Rwandan World Championships, actually. You know, previously I'd kind of thought, is this a good idea? And, you know, what are the reasons behind this? And, yeah, obviously we don't know the reasons behind it, but actually listening to Dan speak made me think, you know, well, you have to start somewhere and you have to create that inspiration somehow. And what effect might that have in another 10 years down the line? You know, who are we going to see at the 2035 World Championships? So it'll be really interesting. It'll be really, really interesting.
Well, yeah. Is it? I mean, you mentioned that. I mean, I thought that a women's Paris-Roubaix was a rubbish idea. Not really. Not really. I thought it was a fantastic idea. But
fire you from the podcast, Dom.
But we should talk. We should talk about Roubaix. You know, it was great to hear you on the podcast following Paris-Roubaix Femme. You know, analyzing the race.
What a race it was! Race.
Yeah, what
it
a
was,
race!
It was just brilliant. I mean, the thing about the men's and the women's races is the men's race is so long, and so I actually was talking to you on Twitter about this, Tom.
That you can remember that.
I haven't actually watched the men's race all the way through before, and my excitement for the women's race has drawn me into the men's race this year. But the thing about the men's race is it's so long that watching the whole thing is really exhausting, like 6.5 hours of coverage. And the men's race was really kind of front loaded with excitement, and it almost burnt itself out. Almost by the end, you know, everything had happened that I was exhausted, the riders were exhausted, the commentators were exhausted. And because the women's race was that much shorter, it was just so jam-packed. It was so intensely packed with action. And I'd say there was only kind of, yeah, the last 9 kilometres, really, where not that much happened. Because by that point, we saw that the race was set. But yeah, I guess we should talk a bit more about the technical side, but I'm just raving about how brilliant the women's race was. No, encouraging you to go and listen back to Paris-Roubaix again. Just listen to it again. I'm sure you've listened already.
It was absolutely fabulous. But tech-wise, I mean, obviously the interesting tech stuff was kind of happening towards the back of the race with things that caught my eye were the Jumbo-Visma's miraculous folding wheels, which...
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know, would you call it a taco? Would you call it a pita, a folded flatbread? I guess it depends where you are in the world.
I'm going to call it a calzone, I think.
A calzone, oh, yeah. Of course. Yeah. And if you didn't see this, there were two incidents. One with Wout van Aert in the Trouée de Arenberg. My French is not very good, so apologies.
That's pretty good, though.
And one with Christophe Laporte, was it maybe on Mont-Saint-Pavel? I'm not sure. Where both of them had Shimano wheels that catastrophically folded in half. And I have to say, I was absolutely amazed with both of them. Their wheels folded in half, which is not something you expect to happen. And they kind of, thankfully it was the back wheel for both of them, they kind of skidded along a little bit and then jumped off. And Wout van Aert thankfully had Timo Roosen behind him, Dutch national champion, whose bike he was able to jump on. Christophe Laporte was left to sort of, in the very Paris-Roubaix way, go, my wheel's just folded in half. I just got to run with
just
my bike.
Just casually
now.
Run down some cobbles, yeah.
And it's funny, I guess Paris-Roubaix is the only way, only race where you don't really bat an eyelid if your wheel folds in half. But it was quite a catastrophic failure. And a lot of people have been saying, well, you know, the effect of riding on a cobble like one finds in the north of France with a puncture does disastrous things to the wheels. But having said that, there were a lot of people riding on flats on the cobbles, and it was only those wheels that we saw dramatically folding in half. So they were actually the last year's edition wheels. They were the 11-speed Shimano wheels, not the new 12-speed ones. So it will be really interesting to see. I mean, I'm sure Shimano will want to keep it as quiet as possible, but there's obviously a bad batch there.
It's happened before. I mean, it takes me back to, I think it was the Vuelta.
The TTT at Tirreno Adriatico.
Was what it was. It was the Tirreno, wasn't it? Yes. Yeah, with Kwiatkowski, I remember his front wheel just completely folded.
It was his front tri-spoke. It collapsed, and there were other faults in some of the other riders, and he was on the front of the TTT, and it just catastrophically took out the whole team. But thankfully none of the riders were hurt in that instant, which is brilliant. But I mean, we saw Ellen van Dijk, actually. She was riding with a flat for, I think she was about 2 kilometers on the cobbles, a front flat as well, so she did remarkably well to hold it upright. And so, I mean, a lot of the riders will have had tubeless and have had tire inserts in, as we were talking about two episodes ago, so go back and listen to that, which will have made a difference. But it's quite interesting. And another of the kind of newer pieces of tech that's come into Paris-Roubaix this year, which I've noticed, I kind of spotted it on social media, actually. It was a post by SRAM. There was a SRAM mechanic from the US who'd come over who was measuring something in the headset. And I sent this to Tom.
Yeah,
and I said,
you did.
What
yeah,
on
yeah.
earth is that? And so I asked Elise Chabé, and it's a small suspension in the headset, which is becoming more and more common, and is a really sensible place to put a small suspension, because often you've put kind of these isospeed decouplers or different things in the seat stays, but it's the rider's hands that get absolutely ruined. And I know Canyon have done it. I think there's a few other manufacturers who've done it as well. Just putting these little bits of suspension in there. And Elise said that she doesn't really know what it is, but it's made a big difference to the way she feels and the way she floats across the cobbles and the feeling in her hands. So yeah, a little bit of tech coming into Paris-Roubaix, which could be helpful, you know, in gravel and in maybe even in rough roads and places like Sheffield where the road surfaces are terrible.
Well, we did talk briefly there about punctures. I mean, it's funny because from the men's race particularly, the sort of the impression of the commentary team was that we were having an extraordinary amount of punctures in this race, a lot more than usual. Now, that can sometimes be a sort of an emotional reaction or a distinctive reaction, you know, when you haven't really done the data analysis. But I mean, from your side of things, speaking to riders, were there more punctures? Is there an issue with tubeless?
I don't think there's an issue with tubeless. I think that, you know, over 365 days of... Well, actually, I say that was only 6 months since the last Paris-Roubaix. You look at something with rose-tinted glasses and you see races where you have a normal amount of punctures, and then you go to Paris-Roubaix and you have a lot of punctures, as you might expect. But this race, the men's race, was the fastest ever recorded. Of course, there's only been two women's races, so it's not really fair to make a judgment. But the faster that you're going, if you hit a pothole at a really high speed, and essentially Paris-Roubaix is just hundreds of thousands of little potholes, or, you know, sharp edges that you hit hard with the front of your tyre where you just go bang. And the faster you hit it, the more likely you are to have a flat. And I think that it's difficult to compare data, but blaming it all on tubeless is probably not fair. I mean, I know my team was actually running tubulars at Paris-Roubaix.
Okay.
Yeah, they felt that with the low pressure that you run and the high chance of riding on a flat for a very long time, because of the cars being way back and, you know, the length of the sectors, that for safety reasons, it was safer to go with a tubular that was glued than even with a tubeless tire with an insert, which is so unlikely to come off. But a tubular tire is even less likely. So it's interesting. It's interesting. But I think the conditions were so good. The riders are saying that it was the best conditions you could possibly imagine, which meant it was so fast that I think that's probably got more to do with it than anything else.
I thought, talking of your team, I thought Tanya looked really good.
Tanya Erath, yeah, she was out in the early break for 60 kilometres or so, leading the race, which is brilliant. Yeah, she looked exceptional, and she was the last of the escapees to cling on. So,
yeah, it was good. And obviously a previous guest on this show as well. So, you know, yeah. a few episodes back talking about riding fixed gear. She comes from a sort of fixed gear criterium scene, which is, so maybe I'll make it into Roubaix eventually with my fixed gear
maybe
skills.
I'll make it into Roubaix eventually.
Well, I'm desperate for you to ride Roubaix. I think you'll go great in Roubaix when you get to ride it. I really do.
Well, I hope so. Next year, Tom, bring you back a cobble.
Next year. Maybe they'll do one every 6 months. It seems to work.
Well, I was thinking that when the UCI said that they were thinking about rescheduling it to October. Well, I thought, let's reschedule it to October now that we've just had it. And then when we get to October, let's reschedule it to April again.
Yeah, I think maybe we have two a year, and then, you know, we have a wet one and a dry one, you know, and you can be the sort of...
The appetite is there.
Yeah, you can be the wet...
And we don't even really officially schedule it. We just say it's going to be around this time in October and we wait until it rains and then we get out today.
That's actually, it's funny because there's a few cycling events that I want to check off my list, and one of the ones I wanted to do was it is like that, you never know when it's going to happen, it just happens when the weather's right, but that's the Headwind World Championships, which I'm desperate to do
in Holland, yeah, of course, of course you have to do on an upright town bike, and I think there's actually a measure of how upright your bike is in order to ride it, and you have to ride in casual clothes, jeans or something, and in flat shoes. It's absolutely brilliant, but listen, you can only do it when there's a howling hoolie.
When there's a hoolie. Well, listen. Well, for an episode of Service Course, I am going to do that one day. So you'll have to come to my house and take over all my duties so I can go. Basically, that's what you'll need to do, Lizzie. Listen, it's been great. It's been lovely to chat to you and about Rich particularly, and about bike racing again, even if you don't remember meeting me for the very first time in Harrogate, which, you know,
I've got photographic evidence that you weren't there, Tom.
I remember because you were in your GB tracksuit, you'd come over, you'd just done some kind of ride or something, I don't know. I think it was a Friday. I feel like it was a Friday.
It was a Friday.
There you go.
The day before the race.
There you go, you see, yeah. Yeah, and I think there was a big name rider in there at the time. Maybe Marianne Vos was in there at the same time. We were looking.
She what? No, Annemiek van Vleuten.
Annemiek van Vleuten was in there. You see, there you go.
Maybe you were there.
So,
yeah, it's easy. Well, sorry about that, Tom.
It's easy to miss me when you're surrounded by Richard Moore and Annemiek van Vleuten. you know, I'd miss me. Listen, Lizzie.
We'll have to ask Paul Watson if he's got photographic evidence of you being there.
Yeah. I had scrambled eggs as well. Listen, I'm telling you too much. I was there. Look, I've made my case.
Actually, now you say that, Tom, that's coming back to me.
You remember the eggs.
Because I wasn't sure what to have, so I think I had a scone and you had scrambled eggs. Now, on that note...
Lizzie, it's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you, Tom.
See you later.
Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.